This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition. I'm Umar Paganam Pike Pagan, and you're listening to an ongoing series that's dedicated to the superhero. An in-depth look at how this uniquely American invention has grown over the last century to become a global cultural phenomenon. An attempt at better understanding this incredible modern mythology and how it's come to bear such an influence over our collective cultures. It is something I call When We Last Left Our Heroes. Batman. Episode 19, The Secret History of Batman. We know Batman. We've seen him in the pages of comic books, on TV, and at the movies for over 75 years. The character is such an indispensable part of global popular culture, the lingo surrounding his world is so pervasive that everyone, comic book fan or not, knows most everything about him.
The Joker, Killer Frost? No. Captain Cold, Penguin,
The Batmobile.
The Joker, Two-Face.
The Joker, Catwoman, Penguin,
Firefly,
Two-Face, Two-Face, Joker, Iceman, is it Iceman? Is it Iceman?
What's that Iceman dude, Poison Ivy? I'm just going back through all the movies. Wait.
Bane. I think that's about it. I can remember.
No. I did Selina Kyle already. Mr. Freeze.
Now, ever since his inception, there has been one credit associated with anything featuring Batman. In the comic books, on television, and the movies. In fact, every single thing to do with the character, comic or movie, cartoon, toy, and video game, comes emblazoned with the words, Batman. Created by Bob Kane. And so, because of those five simple words, you, like me, would have believed that Batman was, in fact, created by Bob Kane.
Well, you're in good company. I mean, he wasn't officially credited throughout his entire life and for more than 40 years after. So that was my goal, was to do my part to help make sure that people knew that Batman was not created just by Bob Kane. And in my opinion, not even mainly by Bob Kane.
That was author Mark Tyler Nobleman.
Hi, my name is Mark Tyler Nobleman. I am an author of books for young readers and all ages, and I'm the author in particular of Boys of Steel, The Creators of Superman, which was the first standalone biography of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And I'm also the author of Bill the Boy Wonder, the secret co-creator of Batman, which was the first book in any format on the original writer and co-creator of Batman, Bill Finger.
And he's here today to tell you and me why everything we know is wrong. Part 1. Everything you know is wrong. It seems to be a common problem in the comic book world, the idea of creators getting, for lack of a better word, shafted. It happened to Siegel and Schuster.
Yes, it did. In a different way. And the people that comics fans say got shafted often have some role in that. They're not blameless. It isn't a victimless. I mean, they weren't completely out of control of their own destiny. But yeah, it was common, especially at the dawn of comics, the golden age in the 30s and 40s. It was just a different era, and it was a different type of industry then, where the value of the storytelling and the art was not valued. It just wasn't considered art yet. So a lot of these guys were happy to be working in the arts, but they didn't think there was any posterity involved. They didn't think anybody would know these characters in 5 years, let alone 75. So looking back, we grit our teeth and we get shudders when we think about the stuff that happened, the work that was thrown out, the people who were disregarded. It's almost criminal from a cultural standpoint. But in those days, that was just standard operating procedure.
Okay, so Bill Finger.
Yes, Bill Finger. So he was a shoe salesman in the mid-1930s, and he wanted to be a writer and an artist. He met Bob Kane, who was an artist, at a party. Bob and Bill went to high school at the same school in New York, but they didn't know each other there. At this party, as the story goes, Bill impressed Bob with his narrative flair. And Bob was already working for National Periodicals, which was the company that would merge and become DC Comics. So Bob saw a diamond in the rough there and invited Bob, invited Bill to work with him. So Bob did get Bill into the industry. And Bill and Bob wrote and worked on some stories that are not nearly as, I mean, nothing is as iconic as Batman in this discussion, but they did some work and through that developed this working relationship. And one afternoon, Bob Kane found out how much money the Superman creators were making, Jerry and Joe, which was, this was would have been 1939. They were making $800 a week, which in those days was quite good, of course, in the Depression. And so Bob said, for that kind of money, I can have a superhero on Monday. This, he supposedly said this on a Friday. He went home, sketched a character, which is in my book and has been done in other ways too, that was quite generic, a guy in a red union suit, a small domino mask like what Robin wears, stiff wings attached to the arms. As far as we know, these sketches don't survive, so we know what they look like because both Bob and Bill would later describe them and their stories lined up. So Bob drew this sketch, and he knew enough to know that it wasn't good enough, and he knew who to call. He called Bill. Bill looked at it and ended up overhauling the entire design. And Bob has admitted this as well. So Bill was the writer who also designed the costume and then went on to create so much more for this character that they called Batman. And Bob went to DC Comics, or National rather, that Monday morning to editor Vin Sullivan with this design, which was the one that Bob redrew based on Bill's input. Bob did not mention Bill. He signed a contract without mentioning Bill. And then he went back to Bill and said, great news, they want to do Batman. So you'll write it, I'll draw it, it'll be my name on it because I brought it in after all, and I'll get paid for it and I'll pay you a portion of that. And that kind of arrangement with the payment was typical in those days. The rest is, of course, to a modern ear, very hard to hear that Bill would sign away his role in this creation, but he did. I mean, at that point, he did. So that was the beginning of the Bill Finger story.
And of course, Bill Finger came up with everything that's almost iconic about Batman. In your book, you talk about the Batcave.
Oh, yeah.
The villains.
Yeah. Yeah. The example I give is you stop a random grandmother on the street and you say, name the first thing that comes to mind about Batman. First of all, she'll know something. Anyone will know something. And secondly, almost every single time it's going to be a Bill Finger contribution. So the short
list. Batmobile, Batcave.
Yeah, let's do the short list. So Bob did come to Bill with the name Batman. Bill gives Bob credit for that. However, just about everything else was Bill. Bill designed the costume. He wrote the first story. He named Bruce Wayne, Dick Grayson in Gotham City. He wrote Batman's origin. He wrote the first stories with Robin, the Joker, the Penguin, Catwoman, the Riddler. He wrote the first comic book stories with the Batmobile, the Batcave, and the Batarang. He nicknamed Batman the Dark Knight. So he built that world.
So what happened? At what point did Bill Finger stop becoming a part of the Batman universe? There was something about Jim Steranko who said that he was a very, very slow writer and DC Comics wanted him out.
Oh, okay. So we're jumping way ahead. That, you know, we just started with 1939 with the debut of Batman, and now we're getting to the 60s. But yeah, Bill was a slower writer, but it was because he was meticulous. He was not lazy. He did a lot of research for his scripts, and he would provide a lot of reference material for his artists, which they loved. They could tell a Bill Finger script without his name on it because he wrote cinematically. He wrote scenes that were fun to illustrate. He understood the medium really well. And in the 60s, there was a group of guys of Bill's generation that was starting to feel older and realizing that they had no pension, they had no health insurance, they had no job security, and they did try to get something from DC Comics that would cover them in that respect, and it didn't work. None of them were on staff. This was all freelance. So nobody was fired, nobody was formally pushed out, but the assignments just started to quietly dry up, not just for Bill, for others of his generation, because it was easier to hire younger people that didn't ask for that. And also they wanted some fresh blood. So yeah, and Steranko interviewed Bill Finger in 1970, which was 4 years before Bill died. And that was the first mainstream interview that Bill gave, and actually the only one in his career. The other times that he was interviewed were, they were smaller scale things that spread through fandom, but were not published in a book or in a formal, you know, in a magazine that you'd heard of. So Steranko was really significant that he got to Bill when he did, and I'm thankful for that. And Steranko's still with us, and I'm in touch with him. He helped me. I mean, he was one of the people that I consulted for the book. He's got a really funny Bob Kane story that has become legendary via Twitter within the last 2 years. I don't know if you heard that.
No. Tell me that story.
I don't know it verbatim, but basically the short story is that Jim Steranko slapped Bob Kane. And And I've met Steranko, and you know, from what little I've seen of him, I totally buy it. I don't want to even try to get it right because I won't remember. Just Google Jim Steranko slapping Bob Kane. You'll hear it. You'll see it. And it was huge when it resurfaced a few years ago. A lot of people loved talking about this on Twitter, online. It was funny. And I don't like to endorse slapping anybody, but it was a good story.
So the story goes that Jim Steranko, known best for his groundbreaking work in the 1960s on Marvel comics like Strange Tales and Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the story goes that Jim Steranko met Bob Kane at the San Diego Comic-Con this 1 year. And you know what? Stay with us, and I'll tell you the story when we come back. You're listening to When We Last Left Our Heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Hello, boys and girls. So if you were listening to this on the radio, there would be ads and music here. But since it's the podcast, let me throw in a little extra bonus content for you. In my conversation with Mark, I had asked him if the reason why Bill Finger went for so long without recognition was because America as a society was far less litigious. Here's what he had to say.
The incident that I think people point to say where it really changed was in the early 90s when a woman sued McDonald's because she spilled hot coffee on herself. You know, I remember when that happened. And that, I think, is considered when we went totally insane. Well, they have to write on peanut butter, warning, contains peanuts. So, yeah. It's just, and while they have to put on television commercials when you see a guy riding his motorcycle, you know, down the Petronas Towers, please do not attempt. You know, that's absurd, but yeah, that's what it's turned into. So yeah, it wasn't like that back in the days before, you know, the golden age of comics for sure.
And now here's part two.
Bodacious, fabulous minds, BFM 89.9.
And somebody collared me in the middle of the day. It was kind of middle of the afternoon. They said, "Would you like to meet Bob Kane?" Well, I had written a lot about.
You're listening to the evening edition and When We Last Left Our Heroes. So the story goes that Jim Steranko, known best for his groundbreaking work in the 1960s on Marvel comics like Strange Tales and Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the story goes that Jim Steranko met Bob Kane at the San Diego Comic-Con this 1 year. They were introduced, and Kane almost immediately began criticizing Steranko's chapter on Batman in his book, The Steranko History of Comics, claiming that he gave too much credit to Jerry Robinson and Bill Finger for their work on the character. Steranko described Kane as an intolerable ass, as pompous as they come, but the real insult came when the conversation ended. Actually, I'm going to let Jim Steranko tell you that story himself. Here he is on a panel at the San Diego Comic-Con 2014.
And we talked for just a few minutes. He was standing in front of the elevator. Obviously, this group was going somewhere. The elevator doors opened, everybody got in. At the last moment, Bob turned around and he said, "See you later, Jim, baby." And he cuffed me across my face. And doors closed before I could do anything. Not my idea. I was in shock, you know, that some stranger would like lay his hands on me like that. "See you later, Jim, baby." I tried. I really, really tried to sleep that night. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And the more time that would go by, the more angry I became about this little incident. It didn't only have to do with this, but it had to do with everything I heard over the years about this guy. Listen to me. Not one guy in the whole history of comics, in the brotherhood of comic artists, writers, publishers, not one guy had a good Bob Kane. story. I walked up to him and I said, "You remember me?" And he said, "Sure, it's Durango." And I bitch slapped him across the face. And I said, "See you later, Bob, baby."
Part 2, Bill the Boy Wonder. For the longest time, for about 75 years, in fact, the world believed that Bob Kane was the artist responsible for Batman, that he was the guy who first infused the nascent superhero genre with a dose of pulpy darkness, creating a Superman rival in the image of Zorro and Dracula. Today, we know that to be a lie. That while Bob Kane's name appeared on every Batman comic, that while he became rich and famous, the man responsible for most everything we know and love about Batman was a brilliant writer by the name of Bill Finger. On the show today, with the help of Mark Tyler Nobleman, I'm telling you the tragic and forgotten story of Bill, the Boy Wonder. So how long was Bill Finger working on Batman?
Started in 1939. His last Batman story was in 1965.
He was working on Batman for almost 3 decades, and we had no idea.
Yeah. In fact, he went public, not through his own doing. Someone came to him and coaxed him out the same year that he stopped writing Batman, by coincidence. And that was the year before the Batman TV show debuted, which made Bob Kane a millionaire. Bill wrote one script and got nothing more from it. And within a decade, Bill was dead. So we got to Bill, in a sense, right on the cusp of him becoming even more obscure, if that's possible. So the guy who did that was Jerry Bales. He's the first hero of this story, the man who rescued Bill from obscurity. And he was just a fan. And I want to say just a fan. He was a super fan, but he was not a journalist or an established writer. He was just a guy that saw an injustice and wanted to help correct it. And he tracked Bill down, interviewed Bill, first person to do that, took this information and wrote a 2-page article called "A Finger in Every Plot," and he made copies and sent it out to Batman fans all over the country. And that's how word of Bill Finger began to spread. This was 1965. So without Jerry, there might not have been a me. I mean, I don't know that we would have ever discovered Bill Finger.
So what happens after 1965? I guess, you know, back then, like you said, the interviews were small scale. There is no virality. There is no internet. These things just don't spread as far and wide as they should.
Right.
So what happens after 65? What kind of traction?
Well, something else happened in 65, which was that the same summer that Jerry Bales interviewed Bill Finger in New York, Bill appeared on a panel at what is considered the first official comic book convention, which was in New York. The reason it's considered the first official one is because there were professionals there. There had been comic conventions prior to that in New York and maybe elsewhere that were smaller scale, that had fans only gathering to talk and swap and buy, but there were no pros. So the fact that there were pros is why they call it that. And it was in New York, and Bill was on a panel with Otto Binder, Mort Weisinger, and Gardner Fox. There must be photos of that somewhere. I wish I found them in my research, but I didn't. But it was recorded, and I do have the audio recording of that, and it's also been transcribed in Alter Ego, which is a magazine about comics history. I think it's issue 20. So that was the first public appearance that Bill Finger made that we know of, probably the first ever. He might have been at one other convention sometime in the 60s that I've gotten wind of, but not sure about that. So between Jerry's article and this panel, Bill did get some interaction with fans, which was, again, after being anonymous for 25 years. You got to imagine what that does to a psyche when you see his work becoming as famous as it did, and he doesn't reap financial or credit-wise any credit for that, or, you know, any recognition for that. So after those two events, again, Bill stopped writing for the comics, and he did write one episode of the Batman TV show. His name was in the credits. That was the only Batman story that his name appeared in the credits for in his entire career. And he was the only comics writer that wrote an episode of the TV show. So there was some small badge of honor in that, but it didn't get him very far. And then he started to do other kinds of writing in the late 60s. He wrote carpentry articles. He wrote B-movie scripts. He wrote army training films. And in the early 70s, he started to drift back to comics. He began to start writing mystery stories for DC Comics. And those were his last scripts, were a couple of mystery stories. And, you know, who knows what would have happened if he had survived. Maybe he would have gone back to Batman.
So in your research and from your understanding, why was Bill himself quiet for so long?
Well, I really tried to get at that because that had never been covered. No one got at Bill, the person. We knew the broad strokes about what he did. We didn't know what the guy was feeling. So part of the issue was that he did agree to this back in 1939. And I think people of his generation were men of their word. There was a sense of honor about you just do your job, and your job is to do your job, not to bask in glory if that is part of the job. So that was the beginning. But then I think as time went on and Batman became bigger and bigger, Bill felt more and more remorse perhaps about letting this go so easily. I think the issue became, it's one man's word against another. It was just two guys in an apartment in New York, pre-reality show. No one was documenting this. Who's going to believe Bill over Bob? Bob's name's been on the character for how many years by that point, whenever Bill chose to come forward? And Bill was no one had heard of him. So I think there was that going against him. I think there was also the idea that Bill really did want to write. And if he started to say what his role was publicly, he might have thought that he would be branded a troublemaker and not get work. And also on a very practical level, to take any kind of real legal action, you need a lawyer, of course, and that costs money. And Bill didn't have money. So in every direction, there was something working against Bill speaking up on his own behalf. I'm not defending that. I wish he did. I wish I didn't have to write the book. But he was that type. I think professionally, he was quite deferential. And he actually was verbally abused by at least one editor named Mort Weisinger, but he was not alone. Mort was quite vicious with other writers too. But there were some just really sad stories of Bill being reamed out by Mort in front of other people as a grown man. And it isn't like he did something so egregious. He might have been late, or he might have turned in a story that Mort didn't love. It wasn't like he ran over Mort's cat with his car. But yeah, Bill just kind of took it.
But what about Bob Kane? Does he end up being the villain of this story? After this, on When We Last Left Our Heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Me again. So you should be able to find Mark's book, Bill, the Boy Wonder, in all good bookshops. If not, Amazon.com will most definitely hook you up. There are also plenty of further reading to be found across the interwebs, and I'd strongly urge you to also check out Mark's blog on noblemania.blogspot. Now, on to part three.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
That's another reason I wrote my book for young readers. I want them to feel empowered to own their work, not to be afraid to say, I did that, and to sign your name with pride. Because some kids are shy about that. They don't want to share their work. They don't want to discuss what they're writing. And, you know, everyone's different. But, you know, if you're going to do this for a living, you've got to be the type of person that says, that's mine. I'm not just going to give it away. It has value. There is a very public discussion about that. So I don't think we're ever going to have a situation on the level of Batman. I don't think there's ever going to be a character that becomes this phenomenon where you find out, oh, there was really someone else who was the main. I mean, there are going to be smaller stories, which doesn't mean that they're not important. But that level of betrayal and deceit and secrecy, I think, is a thing of the past. I think because the fans are too vigilant now. We pay attention to things. People like you. You can access a big name creator and get him and talk to him. And everyone is, there's just a bigger interaction between fans and creators. And so I just think it's harder to hide these things anymore.
This is the evening edition and When We Last Left Our Heroes. That voice you just heard was Mark Tyler Nobleman. And he joins me today in telling you the story of Bill Finger, who was in many ways the real creator of Batman. The man who was, for close to 8 decades, denied the credit he so rightfully deserved. Part 3. Cain and Abel. So where does Bob Kane fit in all of this? How was there repentance on the part of Bob Kane?
Not for a very long time. Bob drew Batman for the first few issues, and then he hired ghost artists within the first half a year of Batman. He had Sheldon Moldoff and Jerry Robinson. They both ghosted Batman within the first half a year. And within the next 2 to 3 years, I'm not exactly sure of the cutoff point, he hired ghost artists to do the work exclusively. So by the mid-40s, Bob was neither drawing nor writing any Batman, and his was the only name on it. Quite a racket. And not only that, but Bob did not write a single Batman story in his entire career. He didn't write a story. And he coasted on this for a while. He reveled in the minor celebrity that this afforded him. I mean, he wouldn't be recognized on the street, but he would tell people, "I'm Bob Kane, the creator of Batman." He claims that he dated Marilyn Monroe, and there's a few other stories like that. And that may be true. I don't know. So in the 60s, when Bill came forward again, he didn't do this on his own. Someone came to him and he agreed. He didn't seek out any glory. Bob was livid. And you can read his response online. You can Google Bob Kane Batmania letter. You'll see his 6-page response to Jerry Bale's article about Bill, in which he basically publicly calls Bill a liar, saying Bill Finger has delusions of grandeur. He is remembering the creation of Batman wrong, which was... That's where I feel Bob Kane becomes inexcusable. In the 30s, what they did was mutual. In the 60s, when Bob had the chance to be an adult and say, yes, okay, yeah, Bill Finger was instrumental, he chose to take the low road and call him a liar. So that's when, for me, Bob becomes fairly unredeemable.
Well, the villain of the story.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, yeah, if there is a villain, he is the villain. But we're talking about real people who have complexity in different levels. And I've talked to people that have lovely things to say about Bob, but they're not from comics. The comics people's stories on Bob all lined up almost to a T. I talked to 9 Golden Agers that all worked with these two guys. I got them all. And they all said the same thing. Bob was not an intellectual. He was not particularly creative. He wasn't a good artist. He was just a good showman. And there's something to that. I mean, that's a talent. And he had good business advice, and he was smart enough to take it. But creatively, he was, you know, a far cry away from Bill Finger, and certainly morally. After Bill died, Bob did express some regret. And he had an autobiography in 1989 called Batman and Me, which was largely ghostwritten by a man named Thomas Andre. So even Bob's own autobiography was not his own work. And Tom is, to me, the second big hero in this story after Jerry Bales, because without Tom, Bob might not have mentioned Bill at all in that book. Tom really got Bob to mention Bill. And in that book, he says a line that's become, for me, the rallying cry of this story, which is, I'm going to paraphrase, but you can Google it and find the exact wording. Bob said in 1989 to his wife, "I wish I could go back in time 15 years to when Bill Finger was still alive and tell him, you're the unsung hero of Batman. Your name deserves to be on it, and I will put it there now."
Yeah.
So it was a confession and a man in his golden years coming to terms with his conscience and he already saw that his legacy would be tarnished by this, I think. So he thought this would fix everything. But to any enlightened person, that's not enough. You can't just say Bill was instrumental, he should be there, and then just forget about it. You can go to the company. You're the one who's got the contract. You can amend it. He didn't do that.
You've got all the power.
Right. So those two moments I really hold Bob accountable. 65, when he called Bill a liar, and 89, when he said that Bill deserved credit but did not follow through.
So, Mark, you're the other hero of this story because your book, in all of my research, your book is being credited as the big, I guess, a big factor in actually getting Bill Finger the recognition he deserves. So right now, 2015, there's been a shift. DC's acknowledged what's going on. So tell us how that happened.
Well, I was definitely not the first, but I was probably the craziest to advocate for Bill Finger.
It pays to be crazy.
Yeah, it did this time. So my thinking was, Bill deserves credit. But I'm a writer. I'm not a lawyer. And I thought that we had a great story here. This was a great story for a writer. It hadn't been done. That makes it even better. So my hope was, if I write a book that gets published and I write it for younger readers, but not just younger readers on up through adult, that's the widest possible audience. If I wrote it just for kids, you know, really simplistic adults would not pay attention. If I wrote it for adults, we'd miss a huge, very vocal group of people that would help. So I wanted to write it for as wide an audience as possible. And the hope was that legally I couldn't do anything, but maybe I could raise an army. I could generate a groundswell of support, raising awareness about this situation, which wasn't really hidden. It just wasn't widely discussed. There was no place to channel this discussion. There was lots of isolated message board posts and tweets and people rumbling at conventions that Bill got screwed. Fine, but we need to harness this. We need to make this something bigger. So the book did become the point around which people could rally. I spoke a lot and I still do. I got a lot of more people to know the name Bill Finger. I just started a campaign to get Bill the Google Doodle for his 100th birthday, which failed, except it succeeded in getting a lot more people to know about this story. And, you know, I've just done as much as I can throughout the book's evolution to raise awareness. So I don't take full credit for this by a long shot, but I can say that it did start with me alone in a room and an idea that did lead to me one by one, Wizard of Oz style, gathering people along the way who wanted to help, who said, "What can I do?" And I said, "The best thing you can do is just raise your voice, just spread the word." DC knew all along about Bill. And in the modern era, they were not disputing any of this. It isn't like they were thinking Bill is not important. They knew, but they work for a big corporation. So the individuals there probably didn't see the path to helping change this, because they're inside, they're in the machine. I'm on the outside. So I have a lot less to lose by pushing for this. Not that they would get fired, but I think some of them probably worried about that on some level. So it really took sort of an outlier to gather the troops.
And it is because of all of this that Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, the brand new mega blockbuster superhero flick from DC Comics and Warner Brothers, will feature Bill Finger's name as a co-creator of Batman. It'll be the first time we see those words on the big screen.
So I should probably explain how we got to that point. When I started the research in 2006, I immediately learned that Bill had a son named Fred. I also learned that Fred was Bill's only child, that Fred was gay, and that Fred died in 1992. So the first thing I wanted to do was talk to Fred, but then I found out that I couldn't, and it seemed like that was the end of the bloodline. The way that it was explained to me was that he was the last finger. And to do anything, to challenge that credit line legally, you need to be an heir. I mean, I could talk about this around the world, and I have, but that is not going to be enough. So through a long, fun, but long story, I found out that Fred was gay, but did have a child. He had a daughter in 1976, which was 2 years after Bill died. So Bill never met his granddaughter. Her name is Athena. She knew what Bill did. She knew what her grandfather's contribution was, but she wasn't acting on it because she had a life. She was a young mom. She had a job. You know, she wasn't thinking like that. So I found out that she existed, and I tracked her down, and I said that this is your birthright. And there are a lot of people out there that would actually be your best friend if you were to try to pursue this. I mean, in other words, they're counting on you the way that we count on Batman in the fictional universe. You could save the day here. And she saw that. She wanted her grandfather to be credited, but it just seems too daunting. I mean, DC Comics, they're owned by Time Warner, billion-dollar corporation. How do you even begin? So I just nudged her to contact them because I thought that being transparent is probably the best way to go. She wasn't sure that she wanted to do that, but she did come around pretty quickly, contacted them. And within a month of that, so this is in the spring of 2007, DC Comics began sending her royalties for reprints of Bill's work. So the company is not trying to marginalize him. They were doing the best they could with the contract. But of course, myself, Athena, and the fans wanted more than that. So that was 2007. Over the next few years, you know, I was just mounting my case online and just beating the drums and just trying to make it inescapable that this happened. So that maybe the company would feel some pressure to do the right thing, even though they knew it was the right thing already. But just to do it, just do it. What are they, you know, it's for them, it's not that big of a deal, probably financially, no matter what they could do about it. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what Batman earns. So long story short, if I'm not too late, Athena did have a discussion with them. This was closed door. I was not part of this. It was just family. And DC Comics did what we all wanted them to do. They agreed to add Bill's name to Batman in September 2015, with, in my opinion, with a great amount of humility. I mean, they began putting that credit on everything right away. Comics, books, TV shows, it's on Gotham. It'll be in Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. It'll be the first time Bill's name is on the big screen. So, you know, the company made good, and it just took a lot of asking. I choke up a lot when I talk about this because this was a big part of my life, and it's just really rewarding to see people do. I mean, I hate to even say right and wrong, but it feels to me like this is the right thing, and people really stepped up to do this. You know, that's why I do give DC Comics props. They're not the villain of the Batman story. They have a different role in the Superman story. Now, the difference is this. Siegel and Schuster were a partnership. They did come together with this character, and they fought together. So their story is a David and Goliath story. They're the David, and Goliath's the big company. Bill and Bob's story also has a biblical allegory, but it's Cain and Abel, brother versus brother, where one brother kills the other, in this one case literally, in the other case metaphorically. But in both cases, there's a Cain. We've got Cain and Abel, and Bob Cain and Bill Finger. So it's a slightly different type of sadness. Jerry and Joe sold all rights, worked on Superman for 10 years, but were making good money in the 40s, but then got fired for suing DC for wanting more. So then for 35 years, they were cut off from their creation. That's desperately sad. But then thanks to Neil Adams, Jerry Robinson, some other people in the 70s, they did get their names restored to Superman. They got money for themselves and their family. They got health insurance. They died knowing that people knew about them, whereas Bill never had any of that. He died with nothing.
That was Mark Tyler Nobleman. I urge you to go buy his book. It's called Bill the Boy Wonder. It's illustrated by Ty Templeton, and it's a product of a lifelong quest to set things right, motivated by nothing but passion and virtue and an unrelenting pursuit of justice. It is nothing short of superheroic. So this week, or next, or whenever you decide to see the new Batman v Superman movie, keep a lookout for those three extra words in the credits. Keep a lookout for Batman, created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.